What's more, knowing how and why typed notes can be bad doesn't seem to improve their quality. Even if you warn laptop note takers ahead of time, it doesn't make a difference. For some tasks, it seems handwriting's just better. Let's unpack the actual passage. The second sentence picks up the idea of typed notes, which was introduced in the predicate of the first sentence. The third sentence is still on this topic. It's talking about laptop note takers. This passage, therefore, will not feel choppy to us because we have information getting picked up from sentence to sentence as given information, and then we're learning new things about it. The next paragraph in the article then brings in the question of education. Let's look at how it starts by referring back to the study. The study is now known information in the article, and then introduces the new idea that this is relevant to education. Here's the passage. The study comes at a ripe time for questions about laptop use in class. Educators still debate whether to allow students to bring their laptops into the classroom. The second sentence in this passage can then go from class, because we talked about introducing technology into class, to educators, and the fact that they're debating this use, and introduce the question of whether students should be allowed to use laptops in class. Again, the passage is taking information we've been given, carrying it over into the next sentence, and then using that to introduce new topics and questions. What we're doing here, what I'm doing with these passages, is mapping how information is presented in terms of the structure or the grammar of the sentences. It is a usefully concrete way to understand how our written content is being packaged and how that might or might not work well for our readers. Here's more good news. There are some basic templates for what readers find helpful in terms of how we package information. I'm going to introduce these useful patterns for adhering to the known new contract over the next few minutes. These will seem very basic, but that is because it's a boiled down map or template. These templates can actually underlie very long, complex, and beautiful sentences sometimes. And it's not that we always have to map out information across sentences according to one of these templates. But I can tell you that it is helpful to think about these if you're wrestling with your own writing or if you're trying to help someone else with their writing that feels choppy. I can tell you as a teacher, it is so much better than just telling a student this feels choppy and sending them off to fix it on their own. Instead, we sit and we map out how the information is working, and they can suddenly see why, as a reader, my head might do that metaphorical jerk up where I think, wait, why did that sentence come right there? So here are three general methods for following the known new contract. The first is what we're going to call constant. What this means is that we're keeping the subject constant as we go from sentence to sentence. Let's imagine the subject is A. So we have A as the subject, and we say B about A. In other words, B is the predicate. So we have A, we say B about A. In the second sentence, we keep A as the subject, and now we say C about A. In the third sentence, we keep A as the subject, and now we say D about A. Here's an example. The study shows that taking notes by hand helps students retain more information. The study further suggests that even when you tell laptop note takers not to take notes verbatim, they still struggle to take effective notes. You'll see there that the subject is literally repeated. It's the study in both instances. Here's another example of this constant pattern that's in some a bit more sophisticated in the way it holds the subject constant. Here we go. Richard Grant White held strong opinions about what constituted correct language. The 19th century grammarian singled out for critique verbs like donate, leave, and state. You can see what I did there. I kept the subject constant. I had Richard Grant White, but in the second sentence, I referred to him as the 19th century grammarian. So using a synonymous phrase, but keeping the subject constant. The second pattern is what we're going to call derived. In this pattern, let's again imagine our first sentence is A, B. A is the subject, B is the predicate that introduces new information about A. In the second sentence, I then have a subset of A, and I say C about a subset of A. You can see why we call it derived. In the second sentence, the subject is a subset of the subject of the first sentence. Here's an example. The time demands on student athletes can be intense. For example, voluntary practices may not always feel voluntary. There we're seeing the first sentence has time demands as the subject. The second sentence has voluntary practices as the subject. Voluntary practices are one of the time demands that student athletes face. The third model or pattern that you can follow here is called chained. Again, for the first sentence, let's imagine A to B. A is the subject, B is the predicate. Now the second sentence picks up B, makes it the subject, and then tells us C about B. The third sentence picks up C from the predicate of the second sentence, makes it the subject of the third sentence, and then we learn D about C. So you get A to B, B to C, C to D. Here we can go back to the boys in the boat example, and I'm going to add my own third sentence just to make this chained, to make the example chained. Daniel James Brown is not in any way responsible for the third sentence. Since early in the 18th century, the London watermen had also made a sport of racing their dories in impromptu competitions. They were rough and tumble events. This informal exuberance could lead to heated debates about cheating and who had actually won. You can see how this passage moves progressively. The competitions that are introduced in the predicate of the first sentence get picked up in the second sentence and become the subject. They were rough and tumble events. Then the third sentence captures that rough and tumbleness in the subject, this informal exuberance, and tells us something about that informal exuberance. Chaining can work well, but I have to warn you here to be careful because it can mean that your paragraph can end fairly far away from where it started because you've been chaining from A to B, B to C, C to D, D to E, and now we started at A and we're at E. Of course, what happens in most actual prose is a combination of these different patterns where two sentences are chained and then the next sentence involves holding the subject constant and so on. With this information about the known new contract in our pocket, it seems like a good time to turn to a few principles proposed by George Gopin and Judith Swan in a terrific article called The Science of Scientific Writing. You can see how Gopin and Swan are building on what we've just been talking about in their subtitle to the article. Here's the subtitle. If the reader is to grasp what the writer means, the writer must understand what the reader needs. As you can see, they're talking about our expectations as readers for how information will be structured. The premise of the article is that scientific writing doesn't need to be as hard to understand as it often is. It is as much or more about the prose than about the complexity of the concepts themselves. As Gopin and Swan write, complexity of thought need not lead to impenetrability of expression. I love this quote. I think it's something that perhaps should be framed on all of our walls, or we should post it above our computer screen as we write. Complexity of thought need not lead to impenetrability of expression. Gobin and Swan reiterate some fundamental principles about known new information. For example, put in stress position the new information, and stress position is usually the predicate. Place the person or thing whose story the sentence is about in topic position. This, as we've talked about, can be a reason to use the passive voice to get the thing you're telling the story about up into subject position. Gopin and Swan note that you should place old information in topic position to link backwards and to contextualize forwards. In general, they say, provide context for the reader before asking the reader to consider new things. It is a very humanizing article as it takes apart scientific writing. For example, they quote the following long passage, and I'm going to quote it in full because it is worth seeing what they're talking about in terms of the impenetrability of scientific writing sometimes. So here we go. Large earthquakes along a given fault segment do not occur at random intervals because it takes time to accumulate the strain energy for the rupture. The rates at which tectonic plates move and accumulate strain at their boundaries are approximately uniform. Therefore, in first approximation, one may expect that large ruptures of the same fault segment will occur at approximately constant time intervals. If subsequent main shocks have different amounts of slip across fault, then the recurrence time may vary, and the basic idea of periodic main shocks must be modified. For great plate boundary ruptures, the length and slip often vary by a factor of 2. Along the southern segment of the San Andreas Fault, the recurrence interval is 145 years with variation of several decades. Gopin and Swan conclude, after quoting this lengthy paragraph, this is the kind of passage that in subtle ways can make readers feel badly about themselves. I love that, because maybe you were feeling bad about yourself as you listened to that paragraph and thought, I'm not sure I'm following. And if you're thinking that Gopin and Swan could have said that it makes readers feel bad about themselves instead of feel badly about themselves, you know that you're right. Now, each sentence in this passage of scientific writing in isolation is fine. It's not too long. It uses the appropriate vocabulary. But look at how the topics jump around when we map them out, which Gopin and Swan do. The first sentence, we start with large earthquakes. Then, in the next sentence, the subject is the rates at which tectonic plates move. Third sentence, we get one as the subject in one may expect. Next sentence, we get subsequent main shocks. Next sentence, great plate boundary ruptures. Then we get, in the next sentence, the southern segment of the San Andreas Fault. As you can see when I map it out that way, we are often getting new information in the given information spot. In other words, we're getting new information in subject position. The theme of the paragraph, which seems to be recurrence intervals, is there, but it's not usefully in topic position. There's lots of great information in this passage, but the reader has to work very hard to follow along. Technical material can be presented more clearly, and I have to say, I think that should be all of our goal as writers. One other good piece of advice is beware of putting too much information in between the subject and the verb. Don't put too much information between the subject and the verb. You think, I would never do that. Well, this can happen. It can happen when we get modifiers on the subject noun phrase, particularly long relative clauses. Let me give you an example. The study, which looked at what happens when people take notes with laptops, with or without access to the internet, versus when they take notes by hand, found that people with pencils retained more of the information. okay, we can make it through that sentence, but our brains have trouble holding the sentence open long enough to wait for the verb. We had the study, and then we got a lot of information about the study in terms of what it studied with laptops, whether people had information, could have access to the internet. And then finally we got found and learned what the study found. It's very hard to hold on to the subject, take in all this other information, and then say, oh, right, here's the verb. So be careful about putting too much information in there between the noun phrase and the subject and the verb. And finally, when is a sentence too long? Gobin and Swan provide one answer to that. They say when there are too many pieces of information that need stress or emphasis. That can be more than one sentence can handle. In other words, look at whether you're trying to introduce a lot of new information in one sentence. If you are, it's probably worth revising. Readers will find the new information, they'll find it more easily if it's in its own sentence, in the new information position. And you want readers to be able to identify and pay attention to the new information that you're presenting. We've been focused intensively here on writing, and I'm going to switch gears in the next lecture to focus on the grammar of speech. As part of that, we'll look at some of the fundamental differences between how we present information in speech and on the page. In formal writing, we don't use well, and we tend to minimize the so's, but these words do useful work in speech. They serve as traffic signals to help our listeners know what's coming, much like the kinds of written strategies that we've been talking about in this lecture.
Lecture 21. What part of speech is
I cannot emphasize strongly enough how different the grammar of conversation can be from the grammar of formal writing. And when we study grammar, we often pull our sentences from literature or from academic writing or from newspapers in order to understand their structure. When I teach my course on the structure of English, I often use an assignment where I send students out now with their phones to record real-life conversations and then to transcribe them. I teach them the conventions where we transcribe every pause, every bit of laughter, every false start. Then we analyze what is happening in those real-life conversations. Students often can't believe how often we speak in incomplete sentences, as well as in run-ons, how often we start a sentence one way and then shift halfway and go somewhere else, as well as how many other little words there are in there. Well, like, you know, I mean, yeah. Obviously, this is less true of very formal speech, especially if it is scripted. Right now, I'm on my best linguistic behavior. Now, I have the advantage that I've had time to think about what I want to say here ahead of time. And I can slow down a little because I know you're not going to interrupt me. I'm also being careful. This means that I will have fewer false starts, but I will have some. Because this speech that I'm doing right now is also more planned, and you and I can't really interact right now, there are also fewer discourse markers, like well and but there are some. What we know from studies is that in classroom contexts, where everyone is in the same room and can interact, formal classroom speech patterns more like informal conversation than it does like a lecture. This is true even if someone is lecturing, as long as they are not completely reading from a prepared speech. Let me show you an example of real classroom talk from a teacher in a high school English classroom talking about Hero and Claudio from Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. Here's the teacher.
So she's still dead, but she didn't betray him. And if he didn't feel so bad, he didn't feel so bad about her being dead when she betrayed him. But now, when when it's his honor, right? When he's at fault now, he's like, oh, I feel really bad about her being dead. Actually thought about it a little bit more, right? We see here in real classroom talk, false starts such as, she's still dead. And now when it's his honor. We also see the effects of real-time processing. For example, when we start with one grammatical structure and then need to do something different because we realize that our sentence is somehow now taking a new turn. We can also see how it's hard to find sentence breaks sometimes in spoken language. That entire passage could potentially be one big long sentence. Then there are all the discourse markers and right. What about right? I have to say, I think that this is maybe a teaching thing. I hear it in other contexts too, but I'm aware that I do it as a teacher, that as I'm talking, particularly if I'm taking a longer turn, I will intersperse these rights as I go. It seems to be a way to signal without stopping, signal my desire for students to be following along. So I'm talking and I say, right, and then I just keep going. Someone pointed out to me that it also can feel sometimes perhaps a little bit coercive. It forces people into implicit agreement if they don't interrupt you after you say right, or it forces them to interrupt you regularly if they want to make it clear that they disagree with you. One other thing I like about this excerpt is that when the teacher quotes speech in it, she puts in a speech discourse marker. When she's quoting Claudio, she says, now he's like, oh, I feel really bad about her being dead. The oh is something we often do when we actually start talking, and she puts it into Claudio's spoken discourse. Claudio was like, oh. One of the reasons to do this is that, of course, in speech, we don't get quotation marks. She needs to signal that Claudio has started talking. We have the like, and then we get the oh to signal that what he's saying has now started. The teacher also uses that quotative like. She says, Claudio was like. The like, as a quotative, usefully blurs direct and indirect speech. We don't know if Claudio actually said what she quotes him as saying, or whether it's indirect speech. He said something like what she quotes him as saying. The quotative like also usefully blurs the distinction between speech and thought. Perhaps Claudio just thought that. He thought, oh, I feel really bad. Quotative like can be very useful, and it is a quotative that many of us are using at this point. This bit of real speech, because it is a monologue, is actually pretty orderly compared with conversation where people are interrupting each other and taking over the conversational floor from each other, or even just back-channeling. Back-channeling is what we do as speakers when we're talking with other speakers and want to show them that we're following along or listening. This can be gestures like nodding your head or smiling. But it often can take the form of those little listening noises that we make. Things like, yeah. That's what linguists call back-channeling. And when you record real-life conversation, you'll often get a lot of simultaneous speech because some speakers are back-channeling. In real-life conversation, people might also simultaneously be watching television or texting or having more than one conversation at once. Real conversation does not look like a movie script. Now, I myself grew up in a home of interrupters. We believe that if you already know what someone's going to say, you might as well interrupt and help them finish so that you can just keep going. We see this as highly cooperative behavior, but I've come to learn that not everyone sees it this way, and I try to be a little better behaved in when I'm talking with people and reduce the amount of simultaneous talk. All in all, when we look at genuine conversation, it can look a bit chaotic. but spoken conversation has a grammar of its own. Of course, spoken utterances are filled with nouns, verbs, adjectives, and adverbs, as well as prepositions, pronouns, determiners, and all the other parts of speech that we've discussed. And we obey all the rules we've talked about for creating descriptively grammatical utterances, except for when we make false starts or get tangled up in our syntax because we change course in the middle of an utterance. It can happen. We might not, though, in speech, follow some of the rules that govern some of the stylistic niceties that we've talked about in this course, such as distinguishing who and whom, avoiding equally as important, or catching a there's three reasons for that. But speech is also filled with words like and well, and for younger speakers, with lots and lots of likes. In this lecture, we'll talk about some of these fundamental differences between speech and writing, and then how those little discourse markers like well and work. To talk about some of these differences in the grammar of conversation and the grammar of writing, particularly formal writing, it's useful to focus on the distinction between involved and informational discourse. This distinction between involved and informational discourse comes from Doug Biber, who's a linguist at Northern Arizona University. This difference captures a difference in terms of the grammar and how we present content. And this difference stems from fundamental differences in purpose. For spoken language, Biber points out, we are very focused on building relationships a lot of the time. And this is the involved discourse pattern. In written language, we can often be more focused on the purpose of delivering information. And this is where we get the informational discourse. Biber has shown that even classroom discourse tends to pattern more like involved discourse, that it's about the relationships that teachers and students are building. It's not in any way just about the delivery of information. Let me describe to you some of the features of involved discourse. This is the kind of discourse that we see a lot in spoken language. You get a lot of first and second person pronouns, I, we, and you. That's unsurprising in terms of conversation. You also get a lot of demonstratives. This would be things like this and that. We do a lot of pointing in conversation with or without specific nouns after it, that we'll talk about this means or that over there. Involved discourse also shows a heavy reliance on to be versus what we've talked about already in this course about powerful, varied writing where you'd see a wider range of verbs. Spoken involved discourse also relies on hedges, things like kind of, maybe, sort of. In addition, we tend to get intensifiers or emphatics, words like very, really, so, super. Spoken involved discourse tends to use a lot of present tense and contractions. Then you get those discourse markers, as we've talked about, well, so, now. Spoken discourse also gives you these coordinated structures, where we get clauses connected by and, or, but, so. You also will see a good amount of the subordinator because. In contrast, let's turn to informational discourse. Informational discourse, and again, this characterizes more formal writing, packs a lot of information into nouns rather than letting full clauses carry the weight. Let me show you what I mean. In spoken language, we might say something like, when the company started. In more formal written language, we might say, at the company's founding. Here's another example. In spoken language, we might say, how we did it was. In written discourse, we might say, the process was, or the procedure was. You can see how that information is getting condensed into just a noun phrase. This process of nominalization, where we turn a verb or an adjective into a noun or a whole clause into a noun, often removes agents and removes active verbs. it can be a very efficient way of transmitting a good amount of information in a short, dense way. But it can also result in very content-heavy nouns that become abstract as they lose the agents doing the actions. I do want to say that this can be something to check in your own writing, especially when you're trying to talk about complex ideas. See if you've gotten all the information packed into abstract nouns and lost the agents. Informational discourse is also characterized by longer words and by attributive adjectives. These are the adjectives that sit right before the noun in the noun phrase, and this is related to this idea that we're packing a lot of information into the noun phrase in informational discourse. You also get what is called a high type token ratio. Let me explain what I mean. What this really captures is that you have a much higher rate of variation in word choice in more formal writing. Here's what we mean by the high type token ratio. Each word is a type, and each token is the time that that word appears in the discourse. So let's imagine I'm writing, and I use the noun exuberance, and I use it only once in the essay I'm writing. Well, that gives me a 1-to-1 ratio, which is very high. But let's imagine the verb to be in a passage of spoken discourse. One verb, to be, I use it 312 times. Well, that would be a low type-to-token ratio. In writing, we often use a word only once or twice because we've learned to avoid repetition. In speech, we repeat a lot because this is actually helpful for people when they're processing in real time to hear the same nouns and verbs and other words come up again and again. The difference captured by the distinction between involved and informational discourse aligns to some extent with the demands of speaking and writing. In speech, we benefit from repetition and from coordination when we're processing in real time. In writing, we can go back and we can look again at a more complex syntactic structure, and we can parse it again if we didn't get it the first time. I have to say this difference is part of why it can be difficult to listen to someone reading a speech, especially if they haven't written that speech to be read aloud. It can be hard to follow. Speech, as we've talked about in this course, can also tolerate much more ambiguity than writing. This is because in speech, we're typically there. We can see on someone's face if they aren't following or if we've said something that's confused them, and we can correct. The fact that written language cannot tolerate ambiguity this way is part of what makes writing really hard. So, those are all differences in grammatical structure, as well as some differences in word choice. One of the biggest differences you'll notice between speech and writing is the presence of discourse markers, like so. When students transcribe for the assignment that I give them in class, they often tend to leave these discourse markers out the first pass they make through the transcription. I think what's happening here is that as speakers and listeners, we've trained ourselves not to hear these little discourse markers as words, as content, so we learn to ignore them. When students go back the second time and they try to transcribe everything carefully, they'll catch all those ums, wells, sos, yes. Discourse markers are these little words, often at the margins of the discourse, at the beginning of an utterance, at the end of an utterance, that help us organize the discourse and manage listeners' expectations. You will see sometimes they happen in the middle, but often they're happening at the margins. People sometimes want to talk about these discourse markers as meaningless, but in fact they do a lot of work for us in conversation. They don't carry meaning the way a noun carries meaning, but they are meaningful for us as speakers and listeners. As we've talked about, these include words such as so, now, well, oh, and, but, and like, as well as lexicalized phrases that have come to function as a unit, such as, you know, and I mean. These discourse markers are optional in the sense that they're not required to transmit the content of the utterance. There isn't a distinction in content between here's the main point and now here's the main point. But these discourse markers can be very helpful, as I'll show you. When they become less helpful is when any one of us overuses a particular discourse marker, at which point that discourse marker can get distracting, and then it can't do its subtle work within the conversation. From the beginning, I want to emphasize that these little words are not just disfluencies that the way that people often think they are. Certainly, sometimes they are fillers. They're a way to hold onto the floor. But that in and of itself is a purpose. If I'm not done speaking and I want to make sure that you know that I'm not done speaking, then I need to make some noise. So I'm talking and then I say, and then I keep talking and you didn't interrupt. First, discourse markers can be like signposts in a conversation. The equivalent of, you turn ahead, or I'm coming to a stop. They can signal to listeners how to understand an utterance in relation to the utterances that precede and follow it. We sometimes call this information management, how the information is building, contradicting what came before, or repairing what came before. That might be the U-turn. Discourse markers can also recognize old information as somehow newly relevant, or that we're winding down here. Or perhaps we're revving up to tell a story. The second thing that discourse markers can do is help the listener understand the utterance in the context of the relationship being negotiated between the speaker and the listener. Am I, as the speaker, trying to connect with you? Am I trying to mitigate the effects of a not very nice thing that I'm about to say to you? Maybe I'm minimizing my own authority. Discourse markers can help me do that. This last point reminds us how much negotiation happens in conversation, both negotiation of the floor, whose turn is it to talk, and negotiation of our relationships with other people, even our closest friends. Think about the grammatical choices we make in terms of how to phrase a request and the ways in which this is a negotiation because it depends on who we're talking to. I might say, save that seat for me. Or I might say, could you please save that seat for me? Or, if I want to be super polite, I'm so sorry to bother you, but is there any way you could save that seat for me? All of those involve a different negotiation with this person about saving this seat. We are always trying not to step on other people's feet or on their toes, in terms of politeness, and just in terms of the logistics of talk. When is it our turn to take the floor? Discourse markers can help with this. For example, we can signal that we're ending a turn. Think about, I'm not sure what I think about that, so... And now you know that I'm done. Or, I'm not sure what I think about that, I mean... And again, I'm signaling to you that I'm finished speaking. Let's look at 5 specific discourse markers to see how they work. We'll start with so, given that it is becoming a peeve for some, given how common it is. For example, listeners are writing into National Public Radio about how often people use so to start answers in interviews. The discourse marker so can do a few different things. It can show the effects or logical consequences, both within one person's turn or from turn to turn, to show that what I'm saying is a logical consequence of what you just said. So can introduce summaries or rephrasings. So the main point here is, within an extended narrative or story, so can also indicate parts of the story. I think about it as the equivalent of paragraph breaks. Here's a story. So while I was driving over here, blah, blah, blah. So I get to the building, blah, blah, blah. So there I am in the elevator, blah, blah, blah. You can see it's narrating those different little episodes within the story. Then let's imagine that you interrupt, and then I need to recommence the story because you've interrupted, and I recommence by saying, so we were in the elevator. You may have noticed that so is on the rise, that you are hearing it a lot. It was featured on a 2012 episode of Lexicon Valley, which is a really great podcast on Slate. And in this podcast, they did interviews with Jeff Raymond at UC Santa Barbara and Galena Bolden at Rutgers. As I noted, many people have noticed that so often happens in response to an interview question. Bolden, in her research, argues that the so used in this way is what she calls an other-centered way to begin. In other words, you ask me the question, and when I say so, it suggests that you've asked me something that I was thinking about, and I have a response for you because I care about you and I've been thinking about this. If I ask a question and I use so at the beginning, it can also make the question seem like my question is a logical consequence of seeing you. So can also be a way to trail off. It passes the conclusion of whatever I just said back to you. Here's the conversational floor. Standalone so can also be a way to prompt action by another person in a conversation. You just say, so? And then it's their turn. Now, let's turn to now. Now can signal a topic shift, like I did right there. I hear myself do it a lot when I'm teaching. I will say, now, let's think about how determiners differ from adjectives. What I'm saying is that we're now turning to a new topic. But now and so can also flag that something important is coming, a main point or a key question. For example, now this raises a fundamental question. These are sometimes called attention getters in speech, and you can think about how helpful they are. Let's just imagine that you're in a meeting where you just happen to be multitasking, and you may realize that you're listening to those little attention getters to know when you need to tune in more closely to what's happening. Let's look at well. There's been some terrific work on well done by Andreas Uecker at the University of Zurich. He notes that well can also introduce a new topic, but here's one of its most interesting functions. Well can preface what linguists call a dispreferred response. A dispreferred response is one that expresses disagreement or is in some way face-threatening. It's saying something that the other person doesn't really want to hear. Let's imagine a conversation in which person A says, people really trust her. And then person B says, well, you know that person B is about to contradict person A or say something that means that, well, I'm not sure everybody trusts her. Here's another example. Someone asks, can you join us for dinner tonight? And you say, well, we know you're about to say no. That's your dispreferred response. Here's one other example. Well, I can see what you're saying, but, and the well signals that that but is coming, that I'm about to say something that doesn't completely agree with you. The discourse marker can do the same thing. The discourse marker O does a surprising amount of work in conversation, and one of its functions is to indicate surprise. You might be surprised how often we want to indicate surprise. Consider getting a compliment. You could say, thank you. Or you could say, oh, thank you. The second makes it seem like you weren't expecting that compliment. You were a little surprised by it. O could preface a suddenly remembered question. Oh, did you ask about when the road will reopen? Or if you remind me of something, I might say, oh, that's right. O can also preface a question or a statement with wrong information. I need to repair what you said. And I say, oh, it wasn't that. Or perhaps I need to repair something I said. I say, oh, it's on Liberty Street, not Washington. Let's now look at two more discourse markers that are phrases that help us navigate relationships with our listeners. One is, you know. You know can conclude an argument. For example, that's just the way I see it, you know? Or it can be the way we trail off at the end of a turn. Because I couldn't figure it out, you know? You know it's your turn. You know can be a way that we introduce a story. You know, when I was a kid, and off I go. But importantly, one of the things you know can do is establish solidarity with an audience. Here's an example from an interview of Ken Wheaton, who's the editor of Advertising Age, on CBS This Morning in 2015. He says, we'll pretend to like PBS, but we really want to go, you know, go home and watch junk on TV. And that you know is saying, you know, you in the audience, you agree with me, you know what I'm saying. You know can seem like it's inviting participation, or at least asking for a back channel. That's a moment for you to nod, because you know. Or perhaps it's inviting disagreement, but it's inviting you to participate. It's difficult if you overuse you know, because if you're saying you know all the time and the person says, wait a minute, I don't know, or if they just get distracted by all those you knows. The phrase I mean can signal that there's an upcoming adjustment in the conversation. I need to repair or adjust. For example, I say, I would never do that. I mean, I'm not saying that I wouldn't think about it. You can see what the I mean does there. The other thing that I mean can do is help minimize the authority of the speaker, which speakers at least sometimes choose to do to make their audience feel more equal. Think about the difference between, I think that would work, versus, I mean, I think that would work. The I mean adjusts a little bit, gives a little more space to you as we have this conversation. I mean can also signal a turn-taking moment. It's another way that we can trail off at the end of a turn. I think that would work. I mean, I'm signaling some hesitation. Now you can come into the conversation. So what part of speech is It's a discourse marker. And linguists often call discourse markers a lexical class all by themselves. The word and, as we know, can be a coordinator. It can also be a discourse marker depending on what it's doing in a conversation. For example, when it's connecting two utterances by different speakers, it can be a discourse marker. Here we have a conversation between person one and person two. Person one says, I started watching the new season of Frankie and Grace last night. Person two, and is it good? That and is a discourse marker that says, my question connects directly to what you just said, and is building from one utterance to the next. Now, you will notice that I haven't talked about like here, and it too can be a discourse marker. It can also be a filler, and it can be a focuser. It's a focuser in something like, it was like awesome. Some younger speakers use like a lot, which can be distracting. As we've noted, this is true of any discourse marker. Here's one student from that class about Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, still talking about Hero and Claudio. The student. Well, I think, in rebuttal, I think he thinks that he loves her. Like, I honestly think that he thinks that he's in love with her, but I think that like, I agree with you, like, he is like a jerk face, and he like only cares about his honor, but I think that he himself legitimately thinks that he like loves this girl. That's a lot of like. Like can signal youth. That's one of the things it can do. This student will, in the long run, benefit from growing out of using this many likes, and the student probably will grow out of it. Awareness is the first step. One piece of advice that I give to students who are trying to wean themselves from like is to record themselves. When you hear how many likes you have in your own speech, it can help you start to monitor for those. So, with that, I will conclude this lecture feeling enormously self-conscious about every discourse marker that I have used for the past half an hour, and I know that you will now be primed to listen for in future lectures, no matter what new topic I'm talking about. And our new topic is going to return to the written language. We're going to talk about punctuation. I've mentioned Oxford commas a few times in previous lectures, and I have kept saying, just wait. Well, we're there. Now we get to dive into commas and semicolons and their other punctuation friends or accomplices, like the colon and the all-purpose dash.
Lecture 22. Duck, duck, comma, and duck.
What is the most common punctuation mark? Let me give you a moment to think about that. What is the most common punctuation mark? What is your guess? I would be willing to bet that none of you guessed the semicolon or the exclamation point. And you'd be right. And probably you didn't guess the question mark either, right? In both American English and British English, according to a 1987 study by the linguist Charles Meyer at UMass Boston, the comma and the period are neck and neck for most common punctuation mark, both of them sitting at 40 to 45% of punctuation overall, with the comma winning by a nose or by the length of an ellipsis, so to speak. Then, in terms of frequency, it goes the dash at 2 to 3%, the semicolon at 1.5 to 2%, then the question mark, the colon, and finally the exclamation mark. Are you surprised that the semicolon is more common than the question mark? I was. In terms of which punctuation marks people are most confused about, I think the comma, the semicolon, and then the apostrophe, which you'll see wasn't in that list, but we'll talk about it. Those three are at the top of the list of the punctuation marks people are confused about. Perhaps also the dash, which can feel a bit like a free-for-all. We'll focus on the comma, the semicolon, the colon, and the dash in this lecture, the punctuation marks that structure the sentence. We'll spend the entire next lecture on the apostrophe. Punctuation is a key part of how we organize language on the page. Sentences end with periods, questions end with question marks, and exclamations end with exclamation points. Sentences do not end with commas, they do not end with colons or semicolons, and they do not end with dashes. Slashes now have very little role to play other than in things like and slash or, but that has not always been the case. Let me provide a brief history on punctuating sentences in the West. The earliest manuscripts in Roman antiquity typically did not have punctuation. Readers were often already familiar with texts, and this way the scribes felt they weren't prejudicing the reading by inserting their own punctuation to indicate how they thought a sentence or passage should be read. The earliest punctuation marks that were added to texts were guides to phrasing. And what I'm talking about here is taken in part from a great book by Malcolm Parks called Pause and Effect, An Introduction to the History of Punctuation in the West. It is a modern notion that punctuation should align with grammatical structure as opposed to spoken phrasing. As I said, that's how punctuation first came in, was to capture how we should say a text aloud. And to this day, not everyone agrees about what the relationship between spoken phrasing and punctuation should be. For English, the printing press started to stabilize punctuation after it was introduced in 1476. But you continue to see lots of variation in punctuation in the Renaissance, including between what was called the virgule, which we would now call a slash, and the comma. The virgule and the comma could be used interchangeably. The comma starts to take over in about the 16th century. Just to show you a few of the differences between punctuation in the Renaissance and today, let me share a couple of lines from a story called How the Witch Served a Fellow in an Alehouse. This story was published in 1606 in a pamphlet called The Most Cruel and Bloody Murder. This pamphlet was the kind of popular publication in the 17th century that catered to the same human interest that sells tabloid magazines today. Here's the passage from this story. At last the witch got so much time to call to him, comma, "Dost thou hear, good friend?" Parentheses, quoth she, question mark, end of parentheses. "What sayest thou, ill face?" Parentheses, quoth he, question mark, end of parentheses. So the dialogue here between the witch and the man is framed by quoth she and quoth he, which is put into parentheses. There are no quotation marks. We just have to figure out from context. She calls, and then we get what she calls without quotation marks. And you'll notice that in those parentheses with the quoth he and quoth she, the question mark is put in what is now the wrong place. It's in the parenthetical, quoth she, question mark, as opposed to at the end of the question that she actually asked. Then there's no period after quoth she or quoth he to mark the end of the sentence. It's the rise of prescriptive grammars in the 18th century that starts to set down stricter standards for how punctuation should and shouldn't be used. But if you read 18th and 19th century texts, you'll still see punctuation used in ways you wouldn't see as standard now. And often that is because there is more punctuation than we're now accustomed to. Let's consider the first sentence of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. "It is a truth universally acknowledged, comma, that a single man in possession of a good fortune, comma, must be in want of a wife." It's a lot of commas for a not very long sentence. We now wouldn't have either of the commas in that sentence. And in some ways, especially the second comma that comes between it's in the, that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. And we would not put a comma in between that subject noun phrase and the verb. The 20th century witnessed some reining in of punctuation so that we were getting less of it. And we'll focus on the modern rules here. Let's start with the rules about commas, and then we'll move on to semicolons and to colons. Commas are designed to mark or set off phrases or groups of words shorter than a sentence. And this is the etymology of comma in ancient Greek rhetoric. There are a few set rules for how to use commas at this point, and then there's some variation. And at the end of this discussion, we'll talk about what the comma splice is, the dreaded comma splice. There are five times when the comma is now recommended, if not required. First, the comma is recommended between two full clauses coordinated by a coordinator, like and, or but. For example, he played tennis for 4 hours yesterday, comma, and his back and arm muscles are letting him know about that today. But you wouldn't put a comma if the second clause is not a full clause, but instead is just a verb phrase referring back to the same subject. In other words, you wouldn't get a comma if the sentence read, "He played tennis for 4 hours yesterday and won 2 of 3 matches," no comma. Why? Because we're told not to separate the subject and the predicate with a comma unless there's intervening material such as a non-restrictive relative clause. Number two, commas around non-restrictive relative clauses. This is actually, these commas are how we show in writing that it's non-restrictive, and it does correspond to a pause in speech.